Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBair, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, today we get to chat with Dwayne Hughes, Managing Director and Chair of UBS's America's Advisory Council. Doug, this man has quite the resume, and I am really excited for our listeners to hear what he has to say.
Yes, I hope we have enough time with all his degrees and just...
I don't know.
Can't wait to find out who's stopping by today.
Jessica, shall we introduce our guest?
So Doug, once again, here we go. We're bringing an absolutely fantastic guest to our Stopping By listeners. As I mentioned earlier, Dwayne Hughes, Managing Director, is the chair of UBS's America's Advisory Council, which we will dig into in just a bit. He has over three decades of experience in law and business, and as an internationally experienced former Wall Street exec, brings a unique multidisciplinary background in economics, finance, international business, and corporate law to his work. He has been recognized for his passion around building inclusive and effective teams and gave a TEDx talk entitled "Check Your Preference and Improve Your Results." So now we can officially check TED Talker guest off our list. We're gonna dive into that as well. Perhaps more than anything, Dwayne is just an all-around super cool guy. And when Doug and I first met him, he just blew us away with what he had to say. So ladies and gentlemen, we present to you the fabulous Dwayne Hughes. Snaps, thanks for stopping by.
Well, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I was thinking about our conversation, our last Zoom. I think it was like halfway through the Zoom, you revealed your age. And before you did that, I was like, how in the hell is this man so accomplished at like, what, 30? 35 years old, and I'm not blowing smoke. I genuinely thought that. And then when you told us your age, I was like, oh my God.
60.
Dude, God, you look good. All right.
So, Dwayne, great place to start is from the beginning. You've had an interesting career in law and financial services for the last three decades, but tell us where it all began. How did you get rolling?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. First of all, thank you very much, Jess and Doug, for having me. Appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity to share my story, my narrative, if you will, life lessons that I've gained over the years with your audience. Yeah, there are three themes to my life professionally. One relates to becoming a lawyer. Another relates to becoming a business person. And the third relates to becoming a multiculturalist. And each one of them started early in my childhood. And of course, I have the benefit of being 60 years old and now reflecting and categorizing and packaging these conveniently into A, B, and C categories. But they developed simultaneously and in overlapping ways, not as clear back in the day as they are now. But when I was a child, I was very interested in fairness, and I would always be complaining or exclaiming to my parents, "But that's not fair. I can't believe this." And I would defend people. And I remember once in elementary school writing a petition against a teacher who I thought mistreated a child. And I think he manhandled. Back in the day, you used to be able to actually physically.
Sure.
We used to call it getting swats. So people would tell me when I was young that you should be a lawyer, right? And that sort of started to stick. And so I ended up taking a lot of philosophy in college. My dad was interested in ethics and exposed me to lots of ideas. And I used to read Aristotle and Plato and stuff and write about it. And that ended up for me going to law school and then practicing law for two decades. The second theme was I was always interested in making money, fascinated with sort of where it came from. And I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio until I was 13 years old. And I remember on weekends, my mom used to take me downtown somewhere and they had shops. Of course, you're talking in the early 70s, right? big thing was football stamps, believe it or not. And the football stamps came in these books that were sold by Sunoco, the gas station, at the gas station. I would buy these in bulk and go and sell them in retail at high margins to my friends, but they were cheaper or easier to get from me in school than they would be to go out Brilliant. Into the neighborhood bodegas or whatever we had.
Yep.
And so I was really arbitraging the difference until a math teacher said, hey, you can't solicit on campus and kill my business. I was interested in business, so I majored in economics, and that led me into the MBA in finance, also at UPenn. And then finally, I had this major experience. My mom exposed me to foreign languages when I was young. We moved to upstate New York, Schenectady, from an all-Black neighborhood to an all-white neighborhood. Mm. And that was a huge blow on my self-esteem. I went from being sort of the favored son to being an ostracized person, really, sure. who suffered real ostracism and discrimination. I went to Germany on an exchange program later, realized I had a gift for foreign languages that sort of restored my interest in academics, and the rest became history. And actually be able to describe certain ideas and phenomenon because of the foreign language that are just not thought of the same way in English, in American
yeah.
English.
Yeah.
So that led me then to focus on Spanish in undergrad, Portuguese and French in undergrad with some German, but then master Portuguese in grad school, which was the master's in international studies and the joint MBA MA program at the Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, then later the JD in law. So those are the three themes: fairness into JD, money into the MBA and business, and then language and culture to become a multiculturalist with the master's from Penn.
I want to talk about your TED talk because you are the first one who's had a TED talk. You talked about it a little bit before. I mean, it was exploring about how, you know, just even growing up, you were on an in-group in one care and on one area, and then you went to a new place, you're on an out-group. And so tell us, first of all, how do you get started? How do you give a TED Talk in the first place?
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's, of course, the main stage in TED, which is like the equivalent of Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's TEDx, which is like off-Broadway.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. So that's an important distinction. My son, Coleman Hughes, is a public intellectual, CNN commentator, author of a book, Joe Rogan, Bill Maher, Whoopi Goldberg with The View. He's actually was on TED, like on Broadway. But TEDx is off-Broadway.
Okay.
And so that's an important distinction. And there's lots of off-Broadway. Now, that doesn't mean off-Broadway is easy. It is not easy in the sense that there are dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of TEDx sort of opportunities. But I, in the time, this is not 2017/2018, I just did this on my own. I applied to 11 places. Two were interested. One said yes. And I went up to Syracuse and did my TEDx. I do a lot of public speaking. It was one of the harder things that I've done, but certainly one of the more rewarding.
It is on YouTube if our listeners want to listen to it. But if you would, give us like a Clips Notes version, if you can distill it for us.
Sure. I lost my wife to cancer. We were married for 23 and a half years. Really devastating. And it's by far the most impactful thing that's happened in my life.
Okay.
By far. I was really happily a husband. People would mention Dwayne and Santa, Santa and Dwayne. We were like one phrase. You know that with couples. You just mention them in one phrase, right? And I went out to start dating again. But one of the things that I realized during the dating process was that it's sort of not like hiring somebody for a job or something where you're looking at their resume and measuring them on objective criteria. I realized I had these strong preferences, very similar to like eating food.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like you can be politically correct and say, well, you know, for my body, I want this healthy salad with some couscous. It's going to have a little bit of bran and whatever. And then when you put that in your taste buds, unless you retrain your taste buds, you like what you like. And so I had like a really politically correct approach because listen, I hadn't dated in decades yeah. and I was on apps. Like who's a 50-year-old guy on apps? Like with a profile. It was ridiculous. I'm like, you need a profile? What is a profile? Right? How I got into this TEDx is like, I realized after doing a certain amount of dates that I actually had some preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, regardless of how appealing you might be, I'm just this type. This is the type of woman that I find attractive because you need chemistry, you need companionship, and you need commitment. Those are the three C's for a successful relationship. And chemistry is sort of like the food sort of is going to have to taste good if you're going to eat it every day.
Yeah.
Right? And your taste buds are a result of decades of eating stuff and programming that you're not going to unwind for political correctness because you think that you can just date the right mind and resume, right?
Yeah.
When I realized I had these strong preferences, when I was unfortunately forced to take the Etch-a-Sketch to zero, Etch-a-Sketch may be a tough term for people, you know, if you're a blank slate.
They can Google it. They'll figure it out.
For Doug, not for me. For Doug.
Okay. For Doug. You're like the millennial here in this conversation.
Exactly.
What I realized to try to shorten the story is that these preferences are so strong that when you realize that because when you're married for a long time, you're not aware of your taste buds. You're just happily eating, drinking your own Kool-Aid. Then when you have to start over again, you're like, oh, actually, that Kool-Aid is a certain flavor. Then you say, I never knew myself to actually consciously prefer this type of person. Then that led me to think of, well, how can attractiveness affect the way you actually hear and listen to people? Could it be the case that somebody's talking in plain English and because they don't meet your central casting, they're not pleasant on the eye immediately to you? You actually hear wah, 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 wah.
Yes. The answer is yes.
And if you're hearing wah, 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 and you're in the professional context, is that limiting your ability to be inclusive, to listen effectively? Does that affect your biases? Will you unconsciously choose not to invite that person to breakfast, lunch, or dinner? How will you spend your discretionary time? If you are associated with historical outgroup members, or you speak with an accent, or your nose looks a certain way, your hair looks a certain way, or your body shape, or you don't have symmetrical facial features,
right,
and you're not pleasant to look at immediately in terms of what society considers pleasant in the context of wherever you are, how could that affect your effectiveness on the job and in the career? And how could that be antithetical to the mission and vision of your company? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what led to the TED Talk.
It was a really one of those things where you're watching, you're like, oh, not me, I'm good. And then you're watching, and you're like, okay, you've given me some things to think about. It's fair. I'm thinking about Dwayne and thinking about everything is sort of in, you're a prolific creator. It's like you don't just do one thing or another thing. After you've done a TED Talk, you'd think, I'll rest on my laurels and I'll market that for that. But you've also created a program called Design the Life You Love. You stay focused on the process, knowing that the desired outcome will take care of itself. So tell our listeners about that program and what prompted you to create it.
Yeah. So after I lost my wife, you're getting a theme here. I've had the life before and the life after. So I'm like BC and AD in my life. It made me focus on or reflect more deeply about the balance among health, family, and career. And I left it all in the field with my wife for the most part. I would give myself a 90 or above. Definitely not 100%. When I had to make choices, for the most part, I opted for family over career. In fact, I left a really prestigious job at a law firm to go work in-house so I could be there to help my wife raise the kids when they were 1 to 3 years old. But I didn't make all my choices that way. I did make some choices that were like career related. I realized that some of them were out of misinformation and out of fear instead of out of goals or out of ambition. Many of us without the dinner table MBA, mm-hmm. right? Or dad and mom with either their own business or second or third generation corporate, we are trained to have a job, not necessarily have a career, doing things like accounting and tax and other technical areas where there's a math and you get the answer. And if you can get the answer and work hard and grind, you'll be recognized and promoted because you're grinding better than everybody else is grinding. In reality, the grinding is the basics. People expect you to continue to grind. But in the United States, you have to also market yourself. And market yourself in a way that is authentic. People don't know what you want in life unless you tell them. They're not going to read your mind. And our culture is somewhat individualistic and it's somewhat free market. And that freedom and liberty means that you have to pursue happiness. But it doesn't mean your employer is going to knock on your door or your boss and encourage you to figure out how you should pursue happiness. That's sort of your job. And so people need to be coached in that regard. So what happens is if you got your head down and you're working so much and you're afraid not to have a job, then you can sacrifice your health because you're worried about being fired. You want that biweekly paycheck. Your parents may have grown up in scarcity because they were depression babies and the like. And so what ends up happening is you underplay your cards, okay? Mm-hmm. And you don't realize your market value. You have a disproportionate sense of loyalty to your employer to your own detriment. And you're afraid of failure as a result. And so the lesson that motivated me to do this program is that failure in business and in your productive capacity can be absolutely the best thing that can happen to you. Mm-hmm. A bad review, disrupted, getting fired from your job, getting up and getting that repetition. It's very much like sports. And I try to get people to really feel like they're an athlete or performing arts, or frankly, any elective course that they had in high school or college that was competitive, that had winners and losers, that wasn't part of the core curriculum. Anything that you did on your own that was competitive, chess club, debate club, soccer, football, drama, performing arts. The reason I say that is because in all of those experiences, you have a coach and the coach says, do it this way or that way. And you don't take it personally, right? You know that they're not talking about Doug and Jessica, the people. They're talking about Doug and Jessica, the players on the field with that uniform.
Yeah.
And as a result, you realize that all those failures lead to success. Whereas with your health and you fail, you can even pass away.
Yeah.
Right. And with your relationships and you fail, they can really be an estrangement from your child or your family, can take decades or generations to recover from. Not so in your career. And your career is actually the trial and error that makes you win. And then in my career, I had several disruptive career experiences. And each of them resulted in an uptick to the last job and something closer to my passion, more money, more responsibility, better. I'm like, wow, why did I play the game like this the entire time? Because I was trained to be risk averse. So I came up with how to get to your true north through this program called Seven Stories. How to develop a one-page marketing plan for your career, not your resume. Mm-hmm. If you're looking to give advice, nobody cares about your resume. It's traditional to lead, oh my God, I did this, I did this, I did the other. I'm like, what I want to hear is, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
Who are your target companies or your target relationships within the company you have? Who's on your personal board of directors? So I can overlap that with my network and LinkedIn and provide you advice. If I have to spend a half an hour getting you there, we've wasted a lot of time because I'm not interviewing you for your job. You're coming to me for advice. And unless you have a strategy that you can outline, very much like an entrepreneurial business plan, pitch. If you're going to ask me for money, you don't have to tell me about your last seven businesses. I'm more sort of looking forward. And then drafting your own job description. And almost nobody ever drafts their future job description. Like nobody would be the architect of their own brand new home. A few people who do it, they tend to get the house they want. Everybody else is just searching from a current inventory. And so these are the tools that I use, and they really work. And we've had hundreds of people now go through the program.
I would like, Doug, I would like you to take note at the amount of notes that I am taking about career advancement, okay, today.
I see that. Yeah,
thank
yeah.
you, Twain.
I see that.
Thank you.
Good thing I have my glasses on today.
Okay, Doug.
Those of you who watch the TED Talk will get that joke. Please watch the TEDx.
Watch the TED for sure.
You'll get the joke about the glasses. And now you'll know what I was talking about. So now you're seeing a little bit more of the inside baseball.
So in the design, The Life You Love, you talk about how to go from one's current unfilled state, presumably, to the target state. And you detail your, quote, healthy strategy, which I think really will resonate with our listeners.
Yeah, it comes back to this fear of failure. What I decided to focus on also is when I look at the three categories, health, physical, mental, family, relationships, career. What I call your productive life. When I looked at those things, I one of the other conclusions about failing in your career could be great, right? The other vector to look at this through is what you control. Mm-hmm. What's in your control, greater in control, are your habits of work, your habits of mind, your habits of health. And if health is the most important thing in your life, which obviously it is, because without it, you have nothing. you can focus on your healthy habits. And that provides the basis for everything else in your life. So I developed a program with some friends of mine, and I came up with the acronym HEALTHY, H-E-A-L-T-H-Y. H for hydration, E for exercise, A for affirmations, saying self-affirmation statements, like, I like myself, I like myself.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I focus on the process, knowing that the desired outcome will take care of itself. L is for logging in sleeps, logging in Z, at 7.5 hours, 7 hours is the minimum, 7.5 to 8 hours. Most people don't sleep. And I would say, without getting into a longer conversation, that's really important. And then T is time to eat. That has to do with intermittent fasting, but it's whatever diet works for you, but not just eating anything and everything that you put your eyes on and being conscious and intentional with your eating. H is for heating your breath, i.e. meditation, some type of organized breathing, if you will, anywhere from 1 minute to 10 minutes a day at a minimum. And then the Y is for yearning to learn. And that's putting in nonfiction positive concepts. Could be motivational speaking, anything. It's not like you're continuing legal or business education. It's more like life lessons type of stuff. Biographies are really great, for example. But there's a lot of flavors of it. And podcasts could be it as well, depending. But it's not news, if you will.
Definitely podcasts.
Hey. Would
I mean, just one example.
If you say so. Dwayne has 3 Ivy League degrees. I mean, so, we could let them know.
There we go. So healthy. So I developed it and it became a competitive game. And we would log in our scores every day and everything. And one guy lost 19, 20 pounds because he had to go to the store and figure out how to buy a cereal that didn't have high fructose corn syrup in it because that was one of the rules one day. So it turned out.
Great, if you could lose 20 pounds, it was just like, oh, just don't drink soda.
Cut out the Fruit Loops.
That's it.
Dwayne, you shared with us that you are a descendant of Wormley Hughes, the enslaved head gardener of Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's plantation. He also was the man who dug Jefferson's grave in 1826. You're a cabinet member and an approved board member of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation. When you find out you're the descendant of this guy, what is that like? Was that just blow your mind?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's great. It's also sort of quite convenient that Wormley Hughes still has my same last name. So that's sort of cool.
All right.
Wormley Hughes was born in 1781. He was the trusted gardener of Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas wrote very fondly of Wormley. Of course, let's not be a mistake. He was one of 600 slaves of the years of Thomas Jefferson. But he was highly trusted. I'm 6 generations from Wormley Hughes. We knew we were from Jefferson and we suspected, of course, Wormley Hughes. But we weren't able to prove it until my mother, who's a genealogist, she's a doctorate in education, but she's a great researcher. She researched Jefferson's farm book. It's called The Farm Book. It's a well-known book. Jefferson was an accountant, an architect. He was a very curious mind, a bibliophile, etc. And he took copious records of every single thing, even with respect to his slave families. And it was then confirmed that Wormley Hughes had Robert. Robert, you know, was at the church. And then through the church records, we were then able to then birth records. Finally, birth records got to be quite reflective in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, in Black Americans could finally track themselves. And so we were able to document every sort of connection. This is like living history for us, even though it's, you know, 250 years. And I'm honored that just by virtue of, I guess, happenstance, I'm the first descendant of slaves on the board of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation.
Does that fact make it onto your dating profile? Because I would drop that anywhere.
I would lead with it.
Absolutely.
That's funny. I'm fortunate to have fallen in love and remarried to a beautiful woman born and raised in Ghana, West Africa, who's been here since college. So I no longer have a dating profile.
Gotcha. But, okay, fair. Maybe the line works somewhere for you.
That's right.
I want to talk a little bit about the UBS America's Advisory Council, which you are shoring up. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this program?
Thank you for asking. Yes, it's been the best. It's the best job of my life. So our tagline is that we bring liberal arts to business. We help UBS respond to its clients and colleagues with the whole human being on an interdisciplinary basis. All of us who are interested in leadership and talent, art, politics, music, higher education, philanthropy. So we have expert luminaries in their field. We have a 4-star Navy Admiral by the name of Jonathan Greenert.
Right.
We have Dr. Mary Schmidt Campbell, the retired president of Spelman College. And we have the legendary basketball coach,
Jay Wright,
of Villanova lore. And these are leaders of major organizations. And of course, there's myself. And we provide money can't buy experiences for clients and colleagues. It's engagement. It's event driven. We also provide enhancement for our colleagues who volunteer and join our ambassadors group at our account. So it's internal grassroots for employees in addition to client facing.
It aligns with our conversation with clients, right? I mean, we don't just spend all day talking about stocks and bonds and investments. And we touch people on a deeper level. And so it's good to know that the firm's also trying to do the same thing.
Dwayne, you are such an accomplished person. You are this man with many different pursuits, and you likely could work anywhere you wanted. Why UBS?
It's interesting because you remember us talking before about writing your own job description?
Mm-hmm.
This was the job when I was able to write my own job description. Now, to be fair, I had had some practice with it. I really knew what I wanted to do. I had a mantra called Recreate by 58. I had gone through several disruptive experiences professionally. And again, each one of them leading to a better outcome. And so I said, well, I really want to take control of my life. The mortgage is either paid off or could be paid off. The kids are out of school. I've written that last college tuition check, right? Which is obviously a huge milestone. Yeah. And I said, well, what do I want to do with my life? And I said, well, I'm an angel investor. I turned out to become an angel investor. I'm interested in board seats. I'm interested in blockchain and crypto. So it was A for angel, B for board seats, C for crypto, D for the Distinguished Careers Institute at Stanford. I was honored to be given a place in a future class of the Distinguished Careers Institute at Stanford University in order to write my memoirs, my thoughts, do the next TED Talk and the like. And I talked to CEO of the Americas who said, wait a minute, didn't you say something about board seats? I said, yeah. He said, I have like an internal board and you'd be a great guy for that. Why don't you come in, report to me, and do a thought leadership for our clients and colleagues. You have an interdisciplinary, interesting background. You're obviously entrepreneurial and a self-starter, self-thinker. You're all about helping out build a culture for those without the dinner table in MBA, which could be of any color or stripe, who identify with that experience. Not exclusively that, but you know, sort of my, that's my sort of disproportionately where I sort of resonate.
Your own group.
That's sort of an in-group where I feel like I can provide leadership and who are attracted to my messages and value add. And we could use that at UBS. Mm-hmm. We could use someone like you at a senior level at UBS, both symbolically and practically. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. I wrote the job description, 800 words. And the fact that I could sort of draw my own, use my own paintbrushes on a blank canvas was the most important thing to me. It's a special place. We're creating special value for clients.
Yeah.
And we're creating a special culture for colleagues. And I'm happy to be a part of it.
So two questions that we ask all of our guests, and I think you touched on this. Your earliest memory surrounding money and how has money impacted your life?
I did talk about a little bit about buying candy and baseball cards wholesale and selling the retail to friends at school. Those are some of my earliest memories about money. I was just sort of fascinated with it. It created value, gives you the ability to do things that you want to do. I didn't really realize until much later working on Wall Street how it is a way that people keep score in a sense. That ability to keep score is more important to some people than it is to others.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to know yourself and have a healthy relationship with money. I think it's very important to know what is enough for you. There's a certain amount of maturity that comes with the knowledge of what is enough for you. And money has, of course, enabled me to pursue my values in the area of health, family and relationships, experiences, and then sort of career in that order. If you earn, save, invest appropriately, then you get to have, it makes, it facilitates life's experiences in accordance with your deepest values.
Dwayne, this may be the first podcast taping where I've wanted to rewind and had my kids sit down and watch this entire thing. I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. I know you're a super crazy busy man, but I have just loved every minute of this time with you. We are really grateful for you and for your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Dwayne, thanks for stopping by.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.